Now, the worlds of science and art sometimes perceived as functioning at the opposite ends of the human spectrum, one involving cold analysis, research, evidence, the other relying on creative intuition and what you might call divine inspiration. But according to Dr. Richard Roach, Professor of Psychology at Maynooth University and author of the book Why Science Needs Art, the two fields are not as mutually exclusive as we might think. First Fortnite Festival, now up and running, obviously brings this a step further, and it links both art and science to mental health. Richard Roach joining me now. I suppose, Richard, the first Fortnite Festival itself, all about promoting mental health through art. So this idea of the sciences and the arts coming together, it's not a new idea, but it is one that we often think that they're separate fields. They aren't really, and certainly not in your mind.
Yeah, not at all. It can seem intuitively like they're on opposite poles of a spectrum, but they share a long history going way back to the early days of science. And if you think of some of the early anatomists, the only way they had to depict what they were studying when they dissected human bodies and anatomy was by drawing them. And the same went for people like Galileo, who had to paint watercolor pictures of what he saw through his telescope. And that's a thread that continues right throughout the history of science, where there's been a lot of overlaps between art and science going right back to some of the earlier scientists.
Yeah, and I also think it's important. I often think it's forgotten that, some of the great scientific theories started as just that, theories where a scientist or a philosopher had to make some kind of intuitive leap, some kind of imaginative proposition that then they used the tools of science to go and prove.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And, within science, the side of the coin that people don't often think about is within science, there's huge scope for creativity. People have to design experiments and come up with novel solutions to problems and novel analyses. And there's enormous scope within that for creativity, for a bit of artistry, and combining these different skill sets and different toolboxes that both camps can use.
Linking that all in then with the whole purpose of the first Fortnite Festival, is it a very simple step to move from there to linking artistic and scientific activity to mental health?
I think it's one that sort of follows on logically in a lot of ways. And I think particularly the theme of First Fortnite is, ideally placed to combine them, because the focus is on the arts and using the arts as a vehicle to open the conversation around mental health. And, breaking down stigma is obviously a huge function of First Fortnite. And there is still a lot of stigma and a sort of stereotype of the troubled genius or the artist with mental health problems that still persists. And it's not really backed up by the data, but it's a persistent and, damaging stereotype that's still around.
How then, can we link in the two things, because that is one of the big cliches, isn't it, that is there, that in fact the great tortured genius, that it is a matter of mental ill health rather than anything else?
Yeah, I suppose it has this kind of cachet about it, this romantic idea of the deeply troubled or disturbed or mentally unwell artistic genius. But, if you look at the number of troubled artists and compared to the number of untroubled artists or the number of people who have mental health issues who aren't working in what you might call creative fields. I mean, one in four of us will have some sort of mental health challenge at some point. So the numbers don't really stack up, but there's a sort of a mystique or an idea that persists that this is somehow beneficial to artists because they deal with creativity and maybe with emotion in a lot of their work. But in oftentimes it's the case that they succeeded despite these problems rather than these issues that weren't the cause or the source of their creativity.
Then from a scientific point of view or from a neuroscientific point of view, if you like, something like listening to a piece of music, what is it about certain pieces of music will calm us down? Certain pieces of music will, get us moving. If we want to go out for the jog and we can't quite get ourselves there, we might have something upbeat going on in our ears. Is there a direct scientific link between those type of, beats or emotions or sounds and what happens in our brains?
In recent decades, there's a new area that's kind of evolved called neuroaesthetics, where we study what happens in the brain when people are shown artistic pieces or pieces that are aesthetically pleasing, or, you know, in other formats, nice pieces of music. And what seems to happen is there's a network in the brain called the default mode network. And this is made up of a collection of different areas that are connected to each other. Hmm. And this network activates in the brain, which it's associated with this sort of peaceful, they call it this state of disinterested interest, when you're in a museum or you're in a gallery and you sort of drift away from your thoughts and get absorbed in a piece of art. And this network overlaps heavily with the brain network associated with autobiographical memory, and it taps into some emotion areas of the brain as well. So sometimes a piece of art, maybe a song or a piece of a painting or a masterpiece, can mentally whisk you back to a certain period of time, to a particular event, or to a particular mood state. So this network seems to be driving these powerful emotional responses that we sometimes experience when we're exposed to art.
What about artists then? I mean, Olivia Messiaen was one from the classical world, and Billie Eilish is somebody who first visualizes songs. But this condition known as synesthesia, where in fact music is often seen in terms of colors.
Yeah, so synesthesia is a fascinating condition where the brains of synesthetes are wired slightly differently to other people, where the sense modalities, sight and sound and touch and smell, they talk to each other in ways that other brains don't. So a lot of those examples there are where people perceive and actually see color when they hear music or different sounds. Mm. Now, there are over 60 types. Other people experience taste when they hear particular words. But in creative fields, this grapheme color or sound color synesthesia is quite common. And people like Pharrell Williams have it, Billie Eilish have it. It's suspected that Jimi Hendrix did, and Kandinsky almost certainly did as well.
Yeah, where he had it the opposite way around, I presume. And David Hockney would have had it the opposite way around. Is this a case where they painted sounds, if you like, rather than they painted colors or shapes or whatever forms on paper?
Yeah, exactly. That sort of sound color phenomenon is relatively common among synesthetes. I mean, synesthesia is relatively rare. About 6% of the population have it. But grapheme color or sound color is a more common type, where people, in some cases, physically see the colors in their visual field when they hear particular sounds or listen to music. And in a lot of cases, you have synesthete artists who basically, they paint what they hear when they listen to music.
I mean, it is quite extraordinary, but I hadn't heard about the one of taste and word before. Is there a term for that?
Yeah, so that's lexical gustatory synesthesia. I think he's the former president of the UK Synesthesia Association is a man called James Wannerton. And James has this condition where you can have a chat with him, and if you say a particular word, it'll trigger, in lots of cases, a very unpleasant taste in his mouth. So you might accidentally say toast, and it might create the sensation of like rotting fish or something in his mouth. So you have to be very careful when you speak to him, because he's quite a nervous guy, understandably.
And I guess the other side of that is, you know, it's very, in some ways, I even refer to synesthesia as a condition, and the presumption is that it's some kind of limiting condition. In fact, as you've described them, they're not limiting at all. They're empowering conditions.
Oh, yeah, in lots of cases, yeah. And there are various other types of synesthesia where people represent numbers in particular ways. And people with these types of number form synesthesia often say that it helps them with addition. And, you know, I'm a synesthete myself, and so is my sister and my niece. And in lots of cases, it just makes life a little bit more interesting and makes the world a little bit more colourful.
And if you don't mind my asking then, what is the nature of your synesthesia? What are the cross-references that you get? And it sounds almost you're lucky enough to get to deal with on a daily basis.
I've a very sort of garden variety synesthesia where I've got coloured days of the week. So I'm what they call an associator type. So I don't actually see the colors in my visual world, but I'm aware that, let's say, Wednesday is yellow in the same way that a banana is yellow. It's just a yellow thing. And Saturday is white in that sort of respect.
Well, you have to know what is Tuesday, so.
Tuesday is a sort of rusty kind of reddish brown color.
Rusty reddish brown. Well, a very happy rusty reddish brown to you. And what color are you doing your talk on this Thursday?
Oh, on Thursday, it's a more sort of like a grey, dark, kind of chocolatey brown.
Chocolatey brown, I think, might be the way to sell your talk. That's Dr. Richard Roach there. He will be in conversation with Dr. Joseph McGrain online, 6 p.m. on Chocolatey Brown Thursday, 7th of January. And the subject will be, what do art, science and mental health have in common? And you can find out full details on firstfortnight.ie.